The following episode of the 9 p.m. Edict contains strong language and is
flavored with the semen of a billionaire.
There is likely to be further disturbing sexual imagery before the night is out. Here, take this lubricant.
Sunday, the 27th of March, 2016. This is take two of the first episode for the new year. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has become the conduit, no, the tunnel of love. But the tunnel of which love?
Love of our fellow man.
Yes, lose yourself in Daddy Malcolm's love tunnel. We revisit the economic wisdom of Joe Hockey.
If housing were unaffordable in Sydney, no one would be buying.
Euro-terrorism sprouts from Brussels. Sorry. And guess who's back?
Tony Abbott will launch his own election tour after the Liberal Party failed to organise him a formal role.
Ha ha, yes. This is the 9 p.m. Let the fun begin. I have no fucking idea what's going on in Australian politics at the moment. It's enough to drive you to drink. Hunter Valley Shiraz I've stolen from Richard Chirgwin. Don't tell him. Look, regular listeners to this podcast, or at least obsessed listeners, will know that I attempted to run this episode as a live stream a few weeks ago, and I ran into technical difficulties, and then I decided that the whole thing should just die in a ditch. Well, since then, so much has happened in Australian politics that I can't possibly summarise all of it. But you know how there are some weeks when you sink that first beer on a Friday afternoon and think, this is proof that there is a God? Well, we've had quite a few of those weeks, haven't we? Well, maybe it isn't proof that there's a God, but at least proof that there are brewers. And, you know, that's pretty much the same thing. I mean, we've had news, and this really is in and of itself evidence that absinthe is a breakfast trick, that yes, as expected, Crusader Rabbit wants to have another go at being Prime Minister. You know, we know he's going to recontest his seat at the election later this year, or, you know, in the middle of the year, it's looking like now. And, you know, why would you bother continuing on being a backbench MP unless you wanted to be PM? Unless, of course, absolutely no one in the private sector were interested in giving Tony Abbott a paying job, and he thought he'd just sit on the backbenches until he eventually rots into retirement. The Rabbit seems utterly oblivious to the calls of fuck off, Tony, even those that come from within his own party. He's utterly oblivious to his own hippo-sized hypocrisy in saying that he wouldn't attempt to white Ann Turnbull's leadership. Oh, no. And then he spends the last few months doing nothing but that, this deluded, medieval-minded throwback to an age when the sheep and cattle had more clue about how the modern 21st century world works than he does. No, Tony's having another go, isn't he? We saw him a few weeks back fronting the TV cameras in his bicycle fetish gear, looking rather haggard without the prime ministerial makeup. In fact, looking less like a national leader and rather more like a disgraced PE teacher. I thought we'd moved on from the Abbott era, but no. Also confirmed, Bronwyn Bishop, the member for McKellar and helicopter fan, will be having another go too. I mean, honestly, her and Abbott, I know they're close friends, well, political friends anyway, which means they haven't stabbed each other in the back yet. But really. I see also that senior lizard Philip Ruddock is possibly back in the running too. I mean, for fuck's sake, even a fucking leech knows when it's full and should move on. I can't imagine what Philip Internet Telephone Ruddock imagines he could actually contribute to Australia's future. And even Tasmanian Senator Erica Betts is having a big sulk. Have a look at Good Weekend in the Fairfax papers over the Easter weekend, and you'll see I'm speechless. Erica Betts actually thinks that the nation is going to suffer without the benefit of his wisdom. So there we have it. Abbott, Bishop, Ruddock, Abetz. It's the core of the old team, desperate to be back on the front benches as if their dried, crinkled asses are attached to the leather like suction cups, a kind of rectal tentacle. Although for that to work, to have a proper airtight seal to form and prevent any anal leakage, you'd need plenty of good old-fashioned petroleum jelly. There will be more about Australian politics as we go along. Hello, I'm Stilgherrian. Welcome to The Edict. I just checked, and that attempted recording of this episode of the 9pm Edict was actually on the 31st of January. That's, well, 2 months ago, really. I hadn't realised it was quite that long. Some of you may know that I've been dealing with some health issues in the meantime, so sorry about that delay. But I noticed back then a photograph in the Sydney Morning Herald with the caption, "Feeling the love, Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull in Melbourne shaking hands with homeless man Kent Kurzweil." Now, you might wonder why the Prime Minister was shaking hands with a homeless person. I mean, Lord Wentworth wouldn't normally soil his delicate little fingers in that sort of way. But there was a purpose to it all, and here's how Channel 7 described it.
Malcolm Turnbull trammed his way to the announcement in Melbourne, giving his fellow travellers a sneak peek of a new website designed to help the homeless. It's called Ask Izzy, an A to Z of services around Australia, from the basics of food and shelter to legal and health advice. After a tour of the Salvation Army's headquarters and meeting some clients, the Prime Minister was exuberant.
What you have today is a combination of technology, innovation and great love. Of love of our fellow man.
Hearing those words from a Prime Minister in one sentence, innovation and love, doesn't happen very often.
AskIzzy.org.au is the brainchild of Info Exchange, RealEstate.com, News Corporation and Google.
This project is an example of innovation for social good.
A University of Sydney study found 80% of homeless people have smartphones, a key tool in staying connected, even when living down by the Yarra, like PJ.
One-stop shop, like everything's there. Like if you're new to Melbourne and you don't know where like to get some food, it's there.
When I was going to school, there's no subject of getting you ready for being homeless. I mean, when this happens, man, you don't know where you are.
The federal and state governments say they'll use the anonymous information gathered by the app to change or introduce new services for the homeless.
They consulted with us all the way through. They actually listened.
Years of street smart knowledge now available in the palm of your hand. Brendan Donoghue, 7 News.
Now, there's problems with this whole idea, and not just the name askizzy.org.au. I mean, who's Izzy? Tell me if you've got any suggestions as to who Izzy might be. Anyway, this app is billed as an A to Z directory of homeless help and blah, blah, blah. You know, you punch in where you are, your postcode or your suburb, and it tells you what services are in your area. Well, it didn't take long for people from Tasmania to see what services they had, and the app showed stuff in Melbourne, in another state, which the app helpfully said was 2 days' walk away, provided you can walk over the turbulent waters of Bass Strait. I suppose Jesus could have walked on the water, and he probably looked like a homeless person rather than the pansexual washing machine salesman he's portrayed as these days. But I can't help but think all of these arsehat ideas to, quote, solve homelessness with apps and disposable cardboard shelters and all of these temporary things are the work of demented people. Do you know what actually solves homelessness? Giving people a home to live in. I mean, the clue is in the word, you fucking morons. And you know what? The state of Utah in the US has almost wiped out homelessness by doing exactly that. Yes, by simply giving them homes for free. There was a good write-up in the Washington Post in April last year, so nearly a year ago now, and I'll quote a bit from it. Quote, For years, the thought of simply giving the homeless homes seemed absurd, constituting the height of government waste. Many chronically homeless, after all, are victims of severe trauma and significant mental health and addiction issues. Many more have spent thousands of nights on the street and are no longer familiar with home living. Who, in their right mind, would willingly give such folk brand new houses without any proof of marked improvement? End quote. Well, the thing is, with the cost of providing emergency services and more health care, and the fact that most homeless in the US go to prison, each chronically homeless person was costing the state of Utah, on average, $20,000 a year. It worked out to be cheaper to give them homes. But it wasn't so much Malcolm amongst the homeless that got up my nose at that time. It was the appointment of that pathetic pudgy puddle of privilege, Joe Hockey, as Australia's ambassador to the United States. And there was that photo kicking around of Joe Hockey grinning wide with pride as he shook the hand of the most powerful black Kenyan in the world. This is totally unfair. Hockey's crime was to be the shittiest treasurer of Australia in living memory. But his punishment was endless cocktail parties and a permanently punchable grin on his face. I mean, let's just refresh our memory, shall we? Here was Hockey's housing price logic.
If housing were unaffordable in Sydney, no one would be buying it.
And here was his sophisticated advice on personal finances.
The starting point for a first home buyer is to get a good job that pays good money. If you've got a good job and pays good money and you have security in relation to that that job, then you can go to the bank and you can borrow money.
Hockey could explain why changes to the fuel excise, which is a tax thing that had put up the price of petrol, would not disproportionately affect poor people.
The poorest people either don't have cars or actually don't drive very far in many cases, but we are actually, you know, they're opposing what is meant to be, according to the Treasury, a progressive tax.
Yeah, Joe Hockey obviously hasn't visited many of the cheaper suburbs. Cheaper not so much in rent prices, but in quality of services. On the outskirts of the city, because if he had, he would see that people have to drive to get around and the distances are much greater than they are in his leafy enclave on Sydney's North Shore. And finally, Joe had a classic bit of anti-working class moralisation about the evils of cigarettes and booze, wrapped in an allegation of poor parenting skills to explain why adding $7 to the cost of every kind of medical treatment wasn't a problem for the poor folk.
One of the things that quite astounds me is some people are screaming about $7 co-payment. One packet of cigarettes costs $22. That gives you three visits to the doctor. You can spend just over $3 on a middy of beer. So that's two middies of beer to go to the doctor. Let's have some perspective about the costs of taking care of our health. And is a parent really going to deny their sick child a visit to the doctor, which would be the equivalent payment of a couple of beers or one third of a packet of cigarettes?
And that's the sort of bullshit that got up my nose about Joe Hockey's time as Australia's treasurer. It was that old trope of whether you're rich or poor comes down to choice, and stupid, selfish you made the wrong choices due to your moral weaknesses. There's simply no concept in Joe Hockey's head that people's choices are limited by the practical realities of their life. Like that whole advice of, oh, we'll just get a good job. Yeah, we can all just do that. And the fact that we don't have a good job is our fault? Well, no. There's not that many good jobs around. There's all those other jobs that people have to do, like flipping burgers and polishing carpets. Or polishing lino and vacuuming carpets, whatever, you know what I mean. when people are living on or below the poverty line, they have to choose which things in their life they are going to abandon. So there's a choice between a medical appointment, even if it's only $7, although, you know, you've also got to get there, which is either driving or a public transport fare, and Susan's lunch today, or Susan's new socks. So Susan ends up going without new socks for a week and is ridiculed by all her friends. You're spending all of your money out of each paycheck to survive for the week or fortnight or month, and there simply isn't enough money left for those large one-off or unexpected expenses. A sudden mechanical problem with the car that costs $2,000? Well, you don't have $2,000 and no one's going to lend you $2,000 because you don't own your home, you're renting it. So the car doesn't get fixed, the back tyre doesn't get replaced, or the home insurance payment just can't happen and you're then not insured so that when you get burgled, you really do lose stuff. You can't pay to have the washing machine fixed unless young Peter skips his annual dental checkup. It's just so oblivious. On the other hand, I was kind of amused by one aspect of Joe Hockey becoming Australia's ambassador to the United States. You've got to remember that the United States values the Australian-American diplomatic link so highly that they leave their Canberra post vacant for 6 months at a time. You know, like no ambassador to Australia at all for half a year. Okay, Australia has such strong operational links with the United States at every level that our Washington Post, Australia's ambassador to the US, is pretty much an ornamental teapot. Still, when Australia banned gay marriage, the United States sent a gay ambassador who was married. So that's a lovely troll, and I can only assume that Joe Hockey is our return troll, and the punchline will come when Hockey splits open like a spider's egg sac and all the hatchlings emerge to eat America. Is it wrong to be thinking about Joe Hockey under the shower, as I have been doing? Because if it is, I don't want to be right. Now, if you listen to this podcast regularly, or if you read my column at ZDNet, or wallow in some of my outpourings elsewhere in the media sphere, you will know that I do like to cut through some of the bullshit that is out there in the world. And a pet topic of mine, as I'm sure you're aware, is the ridiculous exaggeration that happens in the global conversation about terrorism. Now, this week we did see a fairly serious attack in Brussels, in Belgium. We saw multiple bombs. We saw way too many deaths, up in the 30s, and hundreds of people injured. But did it really justify the kind of outrageous language that was used? The most egregious example came from BBC Newsnight, where they interviewed Bernard-Henri Lévy, who is a French philosopher and writer. Here's what he had to say.
It is general war now with Brussels. It's a sort of continental state of emergency. Europe is living now in state of emergency, not only France. It is not only war, it is general war. This is the first point after what happened in Brussels. Brussels is a new scale.
A new scale of general war in Europe. I don't think three bombs going off in Brussels and tens of people killed is a new scale of general war in Europe. I don't think you need to have a degree in modern history to know that to be the case. Bernard-Henri Lévy, you fuckhead. The other bit of bullshit I want to mention this time is science fiction movies. Now, all right, they're fiction, right? We can look over, I suppose, the artificial gravity, which, what is that? We can look over the strange manoeuvres that seem to disregard the laws of physics. We've got used to that in the genre. The thing that pisses me off are ship's computers. Because there's only two kinds of ship's computers in science fiction movies, right? There's type A, should we call them, the disembodied soft voice. You remember this guy?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
Here's another example, the ship's computer from Dark Star.
Attention, attention. Central trunk elevator shaft is now activated.
If you haven't seen the movie Dark Star, do dig it out. It was actually John Carpenter's first ever movie while he was still pretty much a student, and it was made on a budget of $5,000, later increased to a massive $50,000. It's quite fun. Here's another kind of computer voice. This is the type B computer voice, the kind of pert, sarcastic computer voice. This is bomb number 20 from Dark Star.
I recall distinctly the detonation order. My memory is good on matters like these.
Another example is Holly from the British TV series Red Dwarf.
They're all dead. Everybody's dead, Dave.
And from another British series, Blake 7, there was the computer Oreck.
My knowledge is virtually infinite. My secondary ability is to logically process that knowledge and make accurate predictions.
Now, whether you're talking about type A or type B there, I just cannot suspend my disbelief that, no, this isn't how a ship's computer would sound at all. I mean, type A, that sort of soft, ethereal voice, isn't going to cut through the noise and chaos of whatever else might be happening in an emergency. And type B, well, again, you don't want your computer waffling on. You want the damn thing to answer the questions, not get into a philosophical debate about the limits of its knowledge. You want vital information right now. So I want to play for you the sound of a real ship's computer. Well, an aircraft's computer, and in this case, it's the onboard computer, the flight control systems of an FA-18 Super Hornet, just like the ones that the Royal Australian Air Force has. When a pilot first powers up the FA-18, they hear Bitchin' Betty.
Flight controls. Flight controls.
The pilot will hear plenty of Bitchin' Betty during the first 30 seconds of getting the aircraft ready for flight. And then once they're flying, once half the fuel is used and it's time to head back to home, they hear the call of
bingo. Bingo.
And when things are more serious, Bitchin' Betty gets more serious, like this.
Roll right, roll right.
Or like this.
Pull up, pull up.
Now, Bitchin' Betty, or as pilots in Britain's Royal Air Force call her, Nagging Nora, is a real person. Leslie Shook. She's 60 years old and recently retired after 35 years as an employee of Boeing. And that Tennessee twang is real.
We trust that she's telling us what we need to do and we do what she says.
I got a phone call one day from a friend who wanted me to come over. She had an air crew there and he got the call to roll right. Roll right, roll right. I mean, it's now. And he did. And he said if he hadn't rolled right when it said to, he'd have gone in the drink. He'd have died. And that's pretty overwhelming to hear things like that. It's just a piece of me. I suspect I'll be in this airplane as long as this airplane's flying. That's a long time yet.
So may I wish a happy retirement to Leslie Shook? And to anyone creating the sound for a science fiction film or TV series or game, have a think about how the voices are used and get rid of this ethereal crap, please. Mm-hmm. This podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and your subscriptions and one-off contributions. Now, there hasn't been anything new since the last episode, but this episode is number 8 and the final number in a series that were produced, that are being produced, that have been produced as part of the 9pm Urgent Hardware Refresh, in which you paid for all of the equipment that's creating the sounds you are now listening to and sends them on their long, long journey to your ears and other organs of oral perception. And because it's the final episode in that series, it's time for some
casual verbaling.
Casual verbalings go to B-grade evangelists for media freedom, and we have two to acknowledge this time. Stephen Clark works in the School of Information Technology and Mathematical Sciences at the University of South Australia's Mawson Lakes campus. I think the important thing to know here is that Mawson Lakes is not an actual place. Mawson Lakes is in fact a swamp that was filled in with dirt and detritus and the corpses of previous staff members of the School of Information Technology and Mathematical Sciences, some buildings slapped up on top of it, and voila, a new university campus. Stephen Clark is right there pushing for media freedom, and I know that he's made it his personal ambition to find out whose corpses are buried under his office and to give them the recognition they so truly deserve. Ross Nye also works in computing type things. He works as a graduate student in computing science, brackets, embedded systems, end brackets, at somewhere in Melbourne. And I notice here that I've written down in the notes about the kind of acknowledgement he wants, quote, nipples, great hairy nipples, end quote. I can only assume that Ross Nye fondles his own nipples excessively so that they grow and swell and become vast, pendulous udders of manhood. So thank you to both Stephen Clark and Ross Nye. Elephant stamp time! Elephant stamp time. Each episode of this podcast, I give elephant stamps. Elephant stamps, that reminds me of something from a few weeks back. Richard Dawkins was being rude and clueless on Twitter this day. That is to say, it was a day with a Y in it. And it got me thinking, if Richard Dawkins were any bigger a cunt than he is, you'd be able to birth elephant triplets through him. I'd pay to see that. Each episode of this podcast, I give elephant stamps of approval to people who have been exceptional in the category of thinking, and today I have three. The first elephant stamp goes to the government of Great Britain for their work on taxation policy. Now, you know how there's this kind of grey area between minimising your tax, which is a perfectly sensible and reasonable thing to do, to tax avoidance, which goes into a bit of a grey area, and off into, straight-up taxation fraud. David Mitchell was on Adam Hill's program The Last Leg, and look, without going into the details of this particular policy, he made the point quite clearly.
People sort of get to choose, if they're rich, how much they reckon they ought to pay. Where on this moral scale do they place themselves? What can they square with their greed and their conscience? And that's an insane system, because ultimately that's a tax on conscience. That means the better, more conscience you've got, the better person you are, the more you pay in tax. Wow. So we're taxing being nice. Now, any economist will tell you that what you do in government is you tax the things you want to discourage and you don't tax the things you want to encourage. So we tax nicotine because we want to discourage smoking. We tax alcohol. We want to discourage drinking. But we don't tax pension contributions because we want to encourage people to put things into their pensions.
Right.
So what we're doing is we're discouraging people from being nice and having a conscience by taxing it. And that is the most fucking bonkers that we could possibly have come across.
So there's an elephant stamp to the government of the United Kingdom. Our second elephant stamp goes to, well, I'm not quite sure whether it goes to Gary Barry of Columbus, Ohio, or to the United States Secret Service. You have a listen to this report from NBC4 and decide for yourself.
A Columbus man rethinking his post to social media after two Secret Service agents paid him a visit. Good evening. Thank you for joining us at 11. I'm Mike Jackson.
And I'm Colleen Marshall. Last week, our own Candace Lee posted to her Facebook page that Democratic candidates Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton were headed to Columbus. The comment that came later in that conversation caught the attention of authorities. Candace is joining us now from the newsroom to explain what happened next. It's a story you'll see only on NBC4. But Candace, they must have been watching your page.
Yes, looks like I'm on their radar. I can tell you last Monday, I announced on my personal Facebook page that Hillary and Bernie were coming to OSU. Well, the Facebook acquaintance, Gary Barry, saw my post and he responded with something that wasn't too nice that brought those Secret Service agents to his front door.
The post to my personal Facebook page was simple. Hillary and Bernie, Sunday at OSU. Then my Facebook friend Gary Barry chimed in with,
and I jokingly said, so where do I send a bomb?
His comment not popular with other friends. Whoa, said one, and wow, did you really type that for the world to see?
Next day I thought about it, but I'm like, hey, it's the internet. Once it's out there, it's out there. So I didn't think no more about it until yesterday.
When two men with guns and badges came knocking.
I received a phone call from my son while I was at another location saying that there were two gentlemen at the door from the Secret Service, and I thought he was kidding me. But he wasn't, and they actually waited for me to get home.
Gary says the two agents questioned him and his wife, Tony, for at least a half an hour.
Well, they were asking me if I was racist and if I was anti-Muslim and do I have any thoughts of, oh, even says thoughts of suicide or this, that, and the other, and thoughts of assassinating the vice president or the president.
I spoke to the Secret Service here in Columbus. They admit opening an investigation on Gary and interviewing him at length. Resident agent in charge Jonathan Shuck says it's standard procedure for social media threats against the president and presidential candidates.
What was the last thing they said to you?
Watch what I say on Facebook. And I even spread that word as soon as they left.
Free speech or not, Gary's ordeal is a cautionary tale for us all. Big Brother is always watching.
Yeah, free speech or not, whatever. Yeah, free speech, but Big Brother is watching. So don't say, I want to kill the president like I just did. So you decide for yourself whether it's Gary Barry or the US Secret Service who gets the elephant stamp for that one. And the third and final elephant stamp goes to David Presley, 32-year-old man from Georgia, the American one, not the one in Eastern Europe, who lost most of one of his legs during an accident on the 19th of March, after the lawnmower he and his friends were shooting at exploded, sending shrapnel flying in all directions. Now, the reason the lawnmower exploded when he shot at it is that he'd filled it with more than a kilogram of tannerite, which is an explosive that is legal to buy over the counter in the United States. And we're worried about terrorism, right? We can't buy codeine in Australia, but in America, you can buy explosives over the counter. And Tannerite's website describes it as, quote, safe legal fun for shooters from all walks of life. So apparently this thing is designed for this kind of long-range target practice. I don't have a news report to hand, but here's the actual sound of David Presley taking that shot at his lawnmower. Yeah, call an ambulance. Oh, God. Now, as I said, Tannerite is available legally over the counter. And to stress that point, here's the sound of a kid, maybe about 10 years old, with an AR-15 assault rifle.
Today I am going to shoot my AR rifle at a big thing of tannerite. It's going to go boom, boom!
Nice shot, buddy.
Tongue lashings.
A-grade evangelists for media freedom are entitled to a tongue lashing, which is slightly more intense than a casual verbaling. And we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 tongue lashings to deliver. So let's power through them nice and quickly. Paul Williams says that he has rediscovered piano and found that he's not bad at putting a tune together. Well, so he says himself. So as of now, he's changed his career direction and considers himself to be an entertainer, composer, performer, and my own groupie. Which... okay, so he groupies himself. He's also picking up cello, and one day he may start playing it. And he's still playing his high school instrument, the tuba, which is a silly thing, but Mr. Williams thinks it's good. And he still works at the State Library, as he has for a few years now. So all of those musical instruments, I think, together with working at a library, does count it A-grade evangelism for media freedom. Gabrielle Davies works on various consulting things in Canberra. As we all know, consulting is extracting money from, in this case, the government, and therefore the taxpayers of Australia, at some vastly inflated rate to do work of little importance. So in a sense, it's wealth redistribution from the vast masses of poor people in Australia to the pockets, the very deep pockets that are rapidly filled of consulting. Excellent work there, Gabrielle. Rick Heyman is an enterprise architect, he says, and sadly, that is not about starships. See the previous segment on ships computers in science fiction. However, he does note that he is concerned about the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He does not like Twitter's new algorithm to rearrange things to suit itself rather than the carefully set up thing that you have bloody well taken hours to craft. And what do we call it these days? To curate, which is not the same as a curette, as a young lady who's had an early pregnancy will tell you. And he also battles against the encryption. He battles with the encryption against those bastards, those assholes who want to chain us to the past in every way. Excellent A-grade work there, Mr. Heyman. Cheryl, who works in the Pacific region on agriculture and development policy, oh, she wants this one to be Malcolm Tucker-level language and with the accent, please. I can't do a Scots accent. Okay, give it a go. Cheryl is in, oh, I'm going to psych myself up into this. It's Fiji or Vanuatu. Oh, I can't do Scots. Some godforsaken blob of rock in the ocean that you only visit if you've got a brown envelope of stuffed with cash that you need to launder. Apparently the country is run out of sparkling water. It's first world problems. That's it, isn't it? You're going to get that rolling R. First world problems is one thing. Complaining about your sparkling water, love. But when you dribble out your first world problems all over the third world like some 18th century navigator's syphilitic pus. Is that right? Is that Scots? I don't know, but she also, on her Twitter stream, draws attention to a tarot washing machine I don't know what she's been doing with her vegetables. Thank you, Cheryl. Silmobile notes on his Twitter stream, you know Adolf Hitler was afraid of heights. No, I didn't know that, but what sort of useless bloody knowledge you have, you stupid cunt. And it says, there was a tweet earlier, what a great fart. Silvano, that is really B-grade evangelism there. Oh, the freedom to fucking fart. Is that all you can think of? You really need to move beyond the fart, Silvano. Move to a proper, liquid, runny, brown dribble of ooze that runs down the inside of your thighs and sticks to your knees. And you can feel it against your fucking trousers every time you work. There's this squelching sound and the stench just permeates through the whole office, and everyone fucking knows it's you who's done this. You are the person who couldn't control your own fucking sphincters. That's A grade media freedom, Silvano. And finally, Mark Walkham, who describes himself as a solutions architect. Like, what the fuck is that? A solutions architect. Like, I can understand like an actual architect, because you architect houses or skyscrapers or railway stations or knocking shops or sewers or even a fucking opera house. A software architect is a thing because you make software. A network architect is a thing because you create data networks. But a solutions architect, a solution, a fucking, what's it? It's moonbeams and porridge and masturbatory bloody financial fraud, isn't it, Mr. Walkham? Close enough. Look, if you can build something out of moonbeams, then that's pretty A-grade as far as I'm concerned. Thank you, all six of you, for your support. I'd be interested to know what your thoughts are about the future of this podcast, the 9pm Edict, and also my other podcast, Corrupted Nerds, and anything else that might happen. Because at the moment, apart from the last few weeks, I've been doing really too much work on it for not enough income. And that's partially my fault because I haven't been looking for sponsors or hitting you up for money, basically. Now, The Edict, there's really been three kinds of episodes that have come out. Which do you prefer? There's been the news and commentary magazine-y format, as we call it in radio, such as this episode, which does have some regular segments, but it's really bouncing off the topics of the day, week, month, whatever. There's also the Public House Forum episodes, which we've done two of, which are, you know, a panel discussion in a particular location. And then there's been a couple of episodes which have really been a journey to a place with a theme. And the time I went down to Cronulla and visited the suburbs and explored that with Silvano, who you just heard me talk about too with, that's a different thought again. Do you have a preference for how you'd like the podcast to evolve? Corrupted Nerds also. There's the most recent one, which I did a couple of months back now, was me and Leslie Nasser talking about the technology news. Again, I could do them as a panel discussion related to a particular event or as a long-form interview, as most of them were, with one particular person. Tell me on Twitter, email me, message me by whatever way you know to message me, and I'll take that on board and think about where this podcast goes from here. But right now, a regular segment which I'm actually quite fond of, it's Nicholas Fryer with his view through the arch window.
There has now been time enough since the end of the year for the data to be analysed, and the result is clear. The global upward trend has continued, and 2015 was, if not the, certainly among the top three, dumbest years on record. Experts in the field, and my wife, their wives agree with them here, have been saying for some time that there's a clear upward trend in suckiness, stretching back approximately to the invention of people. There are deniers, those who insist that levels of sheer awfulness have plateaued over the last decade. Others admit the obvious trend, but insist that the increase in horridness is due to variations in naturally occurring drivers of yuck. Some effects are indeed to be expected from, say, changes in planetary motion as the world revolves around Kanye West's ever-increasing ego. But for those willing to face facts, the trend is clear and the prognosis nauseating. There were a number of features that made 2015, for Australians in particular, a candidate for enshrinement in the perpetual cabinet of weird. For the first 9 months of the year, the government was led by Tony Abbott, by some metres the strangest creature yet to brachiate through the chandeliers adorning the corridors of power. There was some relief later in the year when he was ousted by Malcolm Turnbull, whose claim to the post comprised more or less entirely not being a simianoid lungfish from the planet Gar. In fact, Mr. Turnbull's dramatic accession to the office of Prime Minister marked, by some measures, the most successful government in Australian history. Despite a fractious party and a hostile Senate, he managed to implement in record time his entire policy and legislative programme, consisting as it did of Mr. Turnbull's dramatic accession to the office of Prime Minister. So the change of leadership failed to reduce the awfulness quotient as much as hoped for, and Canberra continued to suck. The nation found itself enduring the governmental equivalent of an awards ceremony, at which the winner is announced but fails to take the stage, leaving the audience staring at an unattended lectern in an increasingly uncomfortable silence. Into that silence has filtered the mating calls of the friskier gibbons on the fringes of the ruling party, hoots which continue to agitate and resonate with some of the fruitier nuts in the national cake. In the meantime, federal opposition remained the job of the Labour Party, an organisation so called because any contact with them causes recurrent abdominal cramping, followed by the production of a bloody mess that takes the next 20 years or so to sort out. The ALP spent the year pointing out how terrible the government was at everything, including all the things they went on to vote in favour of, which was everything. But do we have any cause to hope that 2016 will be any better? There are some odd signs of life. The ALP has shown one or two signs of actually opposing things. One has some sympathy. After 18 months of leadership by alien lungfish, followed by 6 months by an absence, they've had to go back to the Rudd and Gillard governments to find things they're pretty sure they're opposed to, like discriminatory marriage laws. An election this year seems all but certain now, at some point. A double dissolution poll would provide maximum scope for entertaining savagery, offering the chance for a thorough hosing out of the upstairs ablutions block. With a bit of luck, we could see the back of all of the previously united puppies, that bloke who thinks we don't have enough mass shootings, and, cutely earnest though he is at times, the little chap from the Australian Leafblower Appreciation Society. We'll probably put off until next year the looming national horror of the foreshadowed plebiscite on precisely which class of citizens gay Australians are. Bill Shorten may continue his recent nervous experiments with standing upright and take to bipedalism full-time. Malcolm Turnbull might complete his current project of having his photo taken with each and every living Australian and then move on to a new hobby, perhaps even governing. Heady, heady stuff, but I'll have to leave it with you. I have parenting to do, so I'm off, as most mornings, to puree some perfectly delicious food into an unobjectionable homogenate for feeding to the larvae, and then a couple of hours googling to try and work out if my offspring are normal. Pip, pip.
Two Minutes Hate for Frank Filipponi.
Media freedom thought leaders who contributed even more to the 9pm urgent hardware refresh are entitled to 2 minutes hate, during which I expound upon a topic of their choice for 2 minutes. Frank Filipponi is the first of three 2 minutes hate we have this evening. I find it interesting that to get the computer voice before to say his name right, I had to enter it as Frank Phil A. Pony. Sounds a bit wrong, but Frank would like me to talk about the record-breaking campaign for the Kickstarter project Exploding Kittens and what that says about humanity. Now, if you're not across this, it's, quote, a highly strategic kitty-powered version of Russian roulette developed by Ilan Lee and Shane Small, who are Xbox developers of various kinds, and Matthew Inman from the cartoon, the web comic The Oatmeal. Players draw cards until someone pulls a card with an exploding kitten on, at which point they explode, they're dead, they're out of the game. So kind of like Russian roulette, unless the player has a defuse card, which can defuse the kitten using things like laser pointers, belly rubs, catnip sandwiches, and all of the other cards are to move around or to mitigate or avoid exploding kittens. Okay, sounds like a bit of fun, right? It's kind of a light-hearted thing. This Kickstarter campaign raised $8,782,571. There were 15,505 backers, which means they paid on average $76 each for a few printed cards. What does this say about humanity? It says the asteroid is too fucking good for you. You don't need just an asteroid, you people. You need five asteroids, a supernova, and then someone to get a little hand iron and push it into your face until you finally agree to stop pissing away your money on such stupid things. This isn't a case of individuals with first world problems. It's a case of the first world being the problem. You know, it shows how idiotic these kind of crowdfunded campaigns can be, because once you get enough people with a rush of blood to the head, they'll hand over their money for any damn thing. These three mates, Lee, Idman and Small, they're kind of like reverse hookers. Normally you have to pay the money to get the rush of blood. Well, this is the reverse. You just get the rush of blood and then you hand money over. It's pretty damn indiscriminate. It's pretty damn embarrassing for all 15,505 backers.
2 minutes hate for Jeremy Black.
I got a bit shouty there, didn't I? Jeremy Black, let's see if we can do his 2 minutes hate a little more coherently. Jeremy has asked me to have a crack at Reclaim Australia / United Patriots front and what you think of the fact that Reclaim Australia's Twitter account was hacked. Yes, around about this time last year, April 2015, when a whole lot of these racist rallies really were taking place, the Reclaim Australia folk had their Twitter account hacked, and such tweets came out with things like, "What's wrong with Muslims anyway? I don't get it." It's a fair point. It's one of the greatest religions in the world. Great variety of people. I seem to get on just fine. And I love Vegemite. Who gives a shit if it's halal? Yes, indeed. Why should the fact that someone else determines that it is made in a way that suits their religious needs matter to me? Well, Jeremy, the Reclaim Australia people and United Patriots Front people really are beyond stupid. Their ignorance is so vast you could use it as a hanger for zeppelins. And the individuals themselves, they're just big bladders of bigotry and bile, full of gas, not just hot air. They're full of a dangerous, poisonous gas. As I say, they're beyond stupid. Just a few weeks ago, there was a story out of the United States where one guy started bashing up a Buddhist monk shouting abuse about Muslims. So stupid, he can't even tell who are the people he's angry about and who aren't. Idiots. That's not very Malcolm Tucker language, Jeremy Black, but these people are their own obscenity.
2 minutes hate for Snarky Platypus.
The Platypus has asked me to expound upon the subject, quote, "What is wrong with the urban gay community?" End quote. 2 minutes, I could go for 2 hours. For a start, what is it about inner urban gay men that makes them think that wearing a singlet in a restaurant while people are eating is acceptable? More broadly, the problem of this so-called community is that it's made up solely of men, full of testosterone and not much intelligence. And when you have a male-only environment, you end up with a kind of worldview and a set of activities that simply wouldn't be allowed in a mixed community. Why, for example, are gay men so sexist? Why do they make fun of lesbians, making them an object of ridicule, or at least sort of look down upon them with a sense of superior amusement? You see it all the time. You end up with this kind of blokey activity. All right, it's kind of got a nasal whine to it, but it's indistinguishable from the sort of bullshit that happens at the Oaks Tavern or the long-lamented Arizona Bar. It's just shallow. I saw a line, it's an overheard from Twitter, and I said, so-and-so isn't gay, but he drinks at gay bars because he knows he can take his shirt off and act like a dickhead and not be thrown out. And that's pretty much what gay bars are. The, oh, I'm so good, I'll take my T-shirt off and dance. And it's just disgusting. Then you get this whole sense of objectification. Why do gay men think it's okay to objectify hot men, in quotes, in a way that it'd get straight men who are talking about hot women HR'd straight onto the dole queue? Why is it that inner urban gay men are so shallow and easily pleased about seeing other gay men in the media? Recently, there was a gay couple in an insurance advert. Why was that significant? I mean, does advertising private health insurance make it into some sort of indicator of equality? Really? I mean, you get the feeling that the current inner urban batch of gay men still has their identity politics back in, no, not the mid-1980s, back in the mid-1970s. It hasn't moved beyond visibility. You know, you show an inner urban gay man other gay men on TV and they squeal like a four-year-old. They go, oh, I'm gay, they're gay. And you just have to pat them gently on the head and play them a Kylie song and go, yes, gay men in the media. Paint a rainbow on the street and they think it's Christmas. It's pathetic. I've mentioned the sexism. Add to it the racism. Look at any of the glossy fag mags. You'll see nothing but youngish, muscled white men, usually brunettes these days for some reason. You won't see an Asian face. You won't see a Middle Eastern face. You won't see a black face. And that seems to be across most of the Western world. Look at any of the gay dating, meet for a quick fuck apps, and people openly say, no Asians, or no Middle Eastern, or whatever. No fatties, no this, no that. They're all put-downs which in any other aspect of Western society simply wouldn't be allowed. The same sort of introduction by dick pic that women put up with online, gay men put up with online too. The difficulty is that it's other gay men doing it, so it's accepted as part of the culture. Last year, there was a documentary on ABC TV about the beginnings of gay liberation in Australia, for want of another word for it, in the 1970s. It wasn't about Australia. It was about Oxford Street in Sydney, a couple hundred metres out of a country that's, what, 4,000, 5,000 kilometres across? I kicked off on Twitter. I said, don't let this inner urban Sydney minority define what it means to be gay in Australia, then or now. The gay experience is part of the entire nation, not the 300-metre radius from Taylor Square in Sydney. And the problem with that documentary and more broadly is that the more we keep reinforcing the idea that the gay experience is the inner urban nightclub freak show, the more it pushes the idea that anyone who's gay but who doesn't fit that stereotype is even more of an outsider than they were to begin with. There continues to be this quaint inner urban idea that being gay means you subscribe to a whole package of fashion, bars, mannerisms, music, etc., etc. No, the gay community isn't a community anymore. It's a market segment. It's a white, middle-class, inner urban and not too bright market segment of consumer fags, and it thinks it's so, so special. I'll finish this podcast with a couple of items that will add to the confusion around the Australian federal election that'll be coming up in a couple of months' time. Liberal Party Senator Corey Bernardi, who's a weird right-wing nut job, has actually registered a new political party, a new far-right conservative political party, ahead of his resignation from the Liberal Party. It'll be interesting to see who joins him. Dick Smith, the Australian entrepreneur, who's now getting on a bit, will be running against Bronwyn Bishop for the seat of McKellar. Some people have said that's interesting because he has perhaps a higher profile around the place, but really, we do have such a desperate shortage of old white men in Parliament, don't we? And then, of course, there was the news I mentioned at the very front of this episode, the return of Tony Abbott.
Tony Abbott will launch his own election tour after the Liberal Party failed to organise him a formal role. News Corp reports the former Prime Minister will tour marginal seats across Australia. Mr Abbott insists he's lending a helping hand to the cause and supporting the election of the Turnbull government.
Yes, Tony will be helping. Such a great help, isn't he? Well, how's it going to play out over the next few weeks? Parliament is returning on the 18th of April for 3 weeks of sittings. In that, certain legislation needs to pass, and it won't. And if it doesn't, then the budget will be on the 3rd of May rather than the 10th, and Malcolm Turnbull will be calling a federal election for Saturday, the 2nd of July. We're essentially in an election campaign already, and it isn't so much about Labor versus the Liberal coalition with the Nationals, it's about the internal politics of the Liberal Party. It's going to be fun. I will probably work out some way of contributing my wisdom to that, but even if I don't, hold on for the ride. That's all the edict for now. There's links to stuff on the website. You can leave comments there. There's details of how to leave an audio comment. The next episode of the 9pm edict will be a few weeks away. Date not set, but when that date is set, whenever it is, I'll still be Stilgerian and I'll see you then. Plur.
The 9pm edict is a Skank Media production. Sorry.
Now let's go bury this dead hooker.